Thanks for listening to this Word in Your Ear podcast. If you'd like to get early access to all our productions ad-free, priority booking for our live events, and to take part in our weekly quiz, go to patreon.com/wordinyourear for more details.
You're listening to a podcast from The Word.
Okay, Stack Waddy Game, shall I go first?
Oh, yes, please.
All right, live albums, titles of, with a bit of challenge about them, okay? As live albums frequently do. Okay, you've got to sort out which of these five was not real, okay?
Challenge, I like that. So that's kind of live and dangerous. Is that kind of thing?
Okay, yeah. Okay, first one, on your feet or on your knees? On your feet or on your knees. Number two, blow your face out. Number two, blow your face out. Number three, silent but deadly. Number four, the shit hits the fans. Number five, you can't do that on stage anymore. Okay.
That's really good. So you tell me that four of those are real.
Four of those are real. One of them's not.
Oh, okay. Right. The shit hits the fans. There was a headline in the NME, I think, the fan hits the shit. And I can't remember who it's about now. I think it's about Jimmy Percy of Sham 69. Right. But anyway, so Silent but Deadly, the shit hits the fans. You can't do that on stage anymore. On your feet, on your knees. God, that's tricky. That is. Blow your face out, I think, is real. I mean, I've just got no idea.
Blow your face out is indeed real. It's a Jay Garz band.
Jay Garz, okay.
Live
on your feet, you're on your knees. Sounds real to me. It sounds like a metal thing. Surrender.
It is real. It's the Blue Oyster Cult.
Blue Oyster Cult. The shit hits the fans. That weirdly sounds real too, but I'm going to say it's you can't do that on stage anymore.
No, that's real. That's Frank Zappa. Frank Zappa,
oh, right. Okay.
Series of live albums. The Shit Hits the Fans was a real replacements album, done on cassette only. The one that's not real, but it was fictional, was dreamed up by Spinal Tap, Silent but Deadly. It didn't actually exist.
That's very Spinal Tap. That's very good. You win. Superb work. Okay, well, look, I'm gonna come back with emo.
Oh, right. Okay.
Remember emo, a genre characterized by the idea of emotional expression and confessional lyrics. And it tended to be people like My Chemical Romance and Panic at the Disco, and it tended to be a slightly pessimistic tone to the band names.
And there was lots of eyeliner involved.
There was quite a bit of eyeliner. So okay. Here's five titles, one of which isn't real, okay? Black Veil Brides, And Then There Were None. Yeah, Downhill, But the Brakes Have Failed.
Oh, grief.
From Autumn to Ashes.
Oh, grief.
And Further Seems Forever.
Oh, my God.
I know, it's impossible.
So you're telling me any of those were real?
Yeah, four of those are real. God. Black Veil Brides.
Black Veil Brides, then there were none. Downhill, But the Brakes,
Have Failed.
But the Brakes. Autumn to Ashes.
From Autumn to Ashes.
Further and, seems to... Oh, yep. God. I literally, none of them mean anything to his all. None of them ring even the most distant bell. So I'm going to guess that the made-up one was And Then There Were None.
It's not. No. And Then There Were None. We're on Tooth and Nail Records in 2009. Black Veil Brides is real. From Autumn to Ashes is real, and so is Further Seems Forever. Now, the one I made up was Downhill, But the Brakes Have Failed, which actually sounds a little bit jaunty, really. It's probably just a little bit too optimistic and colourful to be true emo. But there we go.
Sounds as if you've got a sense of humour, which would...
Yeah, which is wrong.
You're emo. Okay, well, that's the Stag Waddy Game for this week. What have we got on next week? We're doing not one, but two Word of Your Attics with... Birthday boys, I think they're boys, they're both boys. Patreon supporters, we've done a few of these already. We've got a couple coming up next week. If you'd like to join them to have your next birthday made unique by the digital presence of me and Mark Ellen in your attics, going through your stuff, if you just go to patreon.com/wordinyourear and you find out all about it and all the many other benefits of being varying different levels of Patreon supporters. So please do go and, as they used to say on the radio, check it out.
The Word Podcast, walking the digital dog since 2007.
Hey, what are you doing for National Albums Day, Mark? Are you having a load of people around? No, I suppose not.
Probably not. I've never completely worked out what National Albums Day is, really.
It's a new thing. You can imagine the three words, National Albums and Day. It kind of, you know, it communicates its essence, doesn't it, really?
It does. It's just general enthusiasm about vinyl, isn't it?
So, well, no, not vinyl particularly, but just long form, you know, albums being CDs or cassettes or vinyl or whatever. It's the idea of a sustained record, which the organisers want to remind people of the value of. And, of course, what are you laughing at?
Oh, no.
You're looking at me as if I've got my flies undone. but anyway, they contacted me a while ago, the organisers, and asked me to name my favourite album of the 80s because they're focusing on the 80s. So I thought we'd follow through on that in this podcast. And I've got five favourite albums of the 80s, and you've got five as well.
I've got five I like very much. Yeah, okay. It's difficult to say favourites because there are so many on the five I'm very fond of.
Well, you see, I posted this on Twitter the other night. I said, Mark Ellen and I are thinking of our favourite 80s albums for National Album Day. And people immediately responded with long lists of the great albums of the 80s. Well, that's not my favourite. Your favourite can only be chosen by me, can't it, really?
Yeah, they've got to be your... It's a personal thing, isn't it?
It's a personal thing.
You have an emotional connection with.
Oh, yeah, it is.
Far away, what do you got then?
The first one was the thing I nominated in response to their question, which was, oddly enough, is John Hiatt's Bring the Family?
Yeah. What a great cover too.
Which came out in... God, when did it come out? It came out in 1987. John Hiatt had been making a load of records for MCA Records, which I think at the time they desperately hoped to get him to be a bit of a country success, and it didn't happen at all. And so he had a few songs, and I think Demon Records, the British, you know, independent label, they said, if you got some songs, we'll pay to record them. If you can just do it in 2 days or whatever. Something quite briefly. And so he put together a band featuring Ry Cooder. And if you can get Ry Cooder, you can usually get Jim Keltner, the drummer, as well. And Nick Lowe flew in, picked up a bass, you know, at a hire shop, I think, somewhere on the way to the studio. And they whacked out this record. And it's just absolutely magical. You know, it very much rejects his efforts to make it in Nashville. One of my favorite tracks is the first track, Memphis in the Meantime, which contains the verse, sure, I like country music, I like mandolins, but right now I need a Telecaster through a Vibralux turned up to 10.
You know, brilliant.
Which is very much what the record sounded like. And of course,
that band was pretty much the band that went on to be Little Village.
Well, that's my point.
Yeah.
That's my point. This so excited people that Warner Brothers said, oh, hang on, supergroup.
You know, yeah, absolutely.
You know, alt rock, I don't know, punk rock, pub rock, supergroup. We'll put this lot together, call them Little Village. And so they then put them back in the studio with a big budget, and they took ages, and it didn't sound anything like as good as that record. And so that's why I chose that, just to indicate that the great albums, they're kind of like magic. You can't do them twice, can you? You
know? No, absolutely.
They just sort of happen. So that's my number five. What's your number five?
That's very good. Oh, I haven't really got them in any particular order, but I was going to start with this one. I don't even remember this.
Oh,
this
is the Feelies. Mighty
Crazy Rhythms by the Feelies.
Okay.
And a collection of bespectacled, slightly nerdy looking collegiate types.
They were nerds before their time, weren't they?
Before
really?
Their time. That's a proto-nerd look, isn't it?
It's a standard look now.
I mean, it is.
So what year are we talking about with that?
That was 1980. Came out in 1980.
Okay.
And they were continuing the kind of grand traditions of the time of kind of East Coast rock music, of, you know, Talking Heads and groups like Television. Very much like Television. Very, very much like speeded up version of Television. And I think it's a brilliant record. It hits a particular kind of tone and sustains it brilliantly. And they're very funny. They're very creative. And there are occasional gaps in the music, which they fill with strange found percussion instruments, cans and shoeboxes and coat racks. It's got an amazing version of Everybody's Got Something to Hide Except for Me and My Monkey.
Oh, cool.
And the opening track is called The Boy with the Perpetual Nervousness, which gives you some idea of the kind of jittery tenor of the whole thing,
yeah,
which is actually very, very attractive. It's really good. And their worldview has the same sort of sensibility as Jonathan Richmond. And so anybody remotely drawn to, the Velvet Underground, the Modern Lovers, and to some extent Orange Juice, sounds very like Orange Juice.
So what happened to the Feelings?
They kept going. No, they kept going, and they kept going to, I think, the early 90s, although that was their big, they were just talked about in the very early days. And I'm fairly sure that they reformed recently too, but I may be wrong.
But
they were a big deal at the time.
I imagine they no longer look like that. They probably filled out a bit, like most of us.
I should imagine there'd be a lot of hats being worn.
Do you know, that's a good idea. I've got that record somewhere. And
it's a good record.
I probably have not played this. So that came out when? What year again?
1980.
Probably have not played my copy since 1980. So I may, you know.
Have a go. It's
I
really
go
attractive.
Back to it.
Yeah, okay. Yeah, I have very fond memories of it.
So my number four is somebody, I've just got about six of her records out, and I'm going to play them all today because I've decided she is the kind of perfect example of the album's artist, even though she became famous through a single, which is probably not the ideal introduction to her career, which is Ricky Lee Jones.
Oh, right, yes.
Pirates.
This is
the second album by Ricky Lee Jones. And obviously the first one was Chucky's in Love and so forth, which was, you know, a big hit kind of out of the box, wasn't it, straight away in the UK. And I probably just didn't pay this record sufficient attention at the time it came out, because it's very much, you know, it was a follow-up to a hit and it didn't do as well as the first record, but it's a better record than the first record. And it is really extraordinary to listen to, because it's really kind of impressionistic and, quite highly orchestrated, and the songs you can't quite grasp, but they're swimming in and out of focus. But it does that thing that great LPs often do, was it kind of changes the temperature of the room, you know what I mean? When you put it on, it seems to fill the space and give you a place to exist, you know? And you think, once I get into the Ricky Lee Jones mood, I just want more of the Ricky Lee Jones mood. And so it's going to be another record by her and another record by her. And it's probably the person I think of as is probably most similar is somebody like Kate Bush. And so, you know, I think it's likely if you like Hounds of Love or whatever, you might like that record. You know, it's the Ricky Lee Jones second album, Pirates. So that's my second.
Yeah, no, they're very similar.
A second personal favourite.
That's a good one. That's a great one.
From the 80s.
Well, mine, again, these are no order, but mine is... is this good record, isn't it?
My goodness.
It's Kite. You know, Kirsty MacColl came out in 1989. Great record.
Now, read me off the song titles.
Songs are Innocence, Free World, Mother's Ruin, Days, No Victims, 15 Minutes. Don't Come the Cowboy with Me, Sonny Jim.
Don't Come the Cowboy with Me, Sonny Jim.
Isn't that great?
It hasn't got England 2, Columbia 0, has it? No, it hasn't.
She's great, though, I think. And I can remember distinctly first discovering her when you and I were at Smash Hits, actually. In fact, she was on the cover.
I put her on the cover.
The guy works down the chip shop, swears he's Elvis, which is the first in a series of songs by her about not suffering fools gladly.
Yeah,
there were lots
of
them. But I thought she was fantastic, and I thought there was something uniquely kind of British about her. You know, there was something very, very kind of raw and unvarnished and unpretentious. And the way she writes about relationships, the way she writes about suburbia, a keen eye for kind of human foibles. Billy Bragg described her as the missing link between between Sandy Shaw and Lily Allen. And I thought that, it's also she's terribly funny. Do you remember she had an album out called Electric Landlady? That's a very good
title.
She
was hilariously funny.
Do you remember that track, In These Shoes? She finds herself in all sorts of situations in her agonising footwear, wherever she's being asked to do is impossible. And somebody says to her, let's make love on a mountaintop. And she goes, in these shoes?
I'll tell you what about Kirsty MacColl. I loved Kirsty MacColl. And she was an absolute delight, as apart from being a great artist. And she's the only person that I've ever thought, and I'll never get round to doing it, because I don't have the skills. And you probably couldn't get it off the ground anyway. Her songs would make a brilliant musical.
Yeah, they would.
Her songs...
They tell stories.
They tell
stories. They're full of incredible characters.
And there's no better case of this than Don't Come the Cowboy.
Don't Come the Cowboy with Me, Sonny Jim. It's just wonderful.
In These Shoes is another classic, you know, obviously that.
Yeah, yeah.
Because, so I occasionally go for long walks, and I fantasize about having the energy or the creativity to put together a song and dance show based on Kirsty MacColl's songs called In These Shoes.
That's great.
Which is
it works for me.
She had also another song from a later album while we're talking about Kirsty MacColl, England 2, Columbia Nil.
Yeah.
Where she goes to watch in a pub and she watches England beat Columbia. And then she kind of falls out with a guy. And it's just England 2, Columbia Nil. And I know how those Colombians feel.
That's so good.
God, she was
There's
good.
A track like that on this record called What Do Pretty Girls Do? Do you remember that one?
Which oh, God, incredible. Yeah, that's
it's
another
incredibly
one.
Incredibly well-reserved, observed tale of this kind of formerly intensely glamorous socialite who's become a complete kind of embarrassment. Yeah. You know, and it's she's got that amazing knack of identifying people that we've all met in real life. Yeah. And we all know somebody like that, actually. It's kind of slightly cruel, but it's absolutely spot on. She is amazing, I think.
I hadn't thought of that record, but yeah, that's a really good it's a good shout, as they say.
Good shout.
So that's your second one.
Yeah, well, yes, absolutely.
My next, oddly enough. Closer by Joy Division.
Oh, right, okay. So, gosh, I would never have imagined you'd come up with that.
I just like this record. Really like this record. I just like the way it sounds. You kind of...
Yeah.
You know, I mean, I know it's doomy and it's full of kind of premonitions of premature death and all that kind of stuff. But you put it on, it's just a thump, it's a rattling good noise, isn't it?
It is. All
the way through. And it's got that thing... of, you know, some LPs, they're just like a sustained single, you know. It sounds like the same thing all the way through, which is, when in the way they do it, is a kind of strength, not a weakness. You know, you're not sitting there waiting for the track that's a bit of a relief or anything like that. No, it's not like that. It's just intensely the same all the way through. And I suppose in that sense, it kind of... It anticipated the way lots of records would be in the future, you know, as the 70s moved into the 80s and into the kind of modern era, I suppose. Even though the record was still made in quite traditional means, you know, so there's no kind of automated percussion on there or anything like that. That was all to come later, I suppose, with New Order. But I just really like it. And quite a lot.
It's before the kind of New Order type instrumentation, isn't it? So you can have you ever seen Anton Corbijn's film Closer?
The band play,
and it's actually they sound incredibly like them because it's just bass, drums, guitar, and vocal.
Yeah, yeah.
And they managed to kind of synthesize that noise incredibly well. That's a fantastic record. Good one.
So Those are my first three.
Very good. My next one is again another American group. Do you ever remember these guys, the DBs?
Oh, I can tell you a story about the DBs.
Oh, good. No. DBs. They formed in 1979, 78, I think, and this came out in 82. And this is Repercussion. And there was there's always that kind of tally of all the groups that were carrying on the great works of the Beatles. The bands that would sound like the Beatles were still going, the millions of them. Big Star, a really good example. And these guys actually sound very like Big Star. And I think these people are quite a good example of that. You can remember they had two songwriters. It was Chris Stamey, who had that kind of acerbic kind of Lennon tone to the way he looked at the world. And then there was Peter Holsapple, who was much given to those kind of McCartney-like melodic flourishes. And they're very like Big Star. There was something of an influence on REM. I think REM kind of stole a lot of that kind of early idea of their sound pattern from them. And this is a kind of slightly psychedelic, but and slightly acid collection of kind of power pop songs about them and the curious, you know, social circle. I think it's wonderful.
Peter Holsapple turned over years later with REM, didn't he? He was a mate of REM.
He was.
He used to play with them on tour. Now, I'll tell you my DB story. I've got that record. And when that record came out, I interviewed them. For what? I don't know. I can't remember. But I was in New York, and I was staying at the Gramercy Park Hotel, which in those days was the rock and roll hotel. And Peter and Chris came round to my room. And they're perfectly, I'd met them before. They were perfectly nice guys, and had a perfectly good relationship with them. And halfway through the interview, which I must have been taping in my hotel room, Chris Stamey just got up and walked out. No explanation. Nothing.
Didn't say I refuse to answer that question. No, How dare you go off script? My PR told you not to.
There was nothing like that. And they wouldn't have done that anyway. There was nothing like that.
How bizarre.
He just got up, some switch went, he got up, walked out, and Peter was very apologetic, but clearly was quite used to it happening. They were just very, very different people.
Different. I can remember meeting them after a Dingwalls gig, and Chris Daly being impossible to deal with, and Peter Holsapple being,
genial
host, hail fellow, well met.
So absolutely. I still don't know to this day whether it was anything I said. I'm pretty sure it wasn't, But you see, you never can tell. It's funny when you interview groups, you may say things completely innocently. Particularly if you're interviewing,
and they take them as a threat or a.
Well, you may have just flicked a switch somewhere, and you wouldn't be remotely aware of having done it, because you may have just said something completely innocently, which they in the group think, oh, my God, he knows about so-and-so. Or what, you know what I mean?
Yeah.
Because they've always got a secret agenda, haven't they?
Yeah.
And it could have been one of those things. I don't know. It's a long time ago. It's 40 years ago. So
the only person who's ever walked out of an interview I've done was Steve Forbert. Do you remember Steve Forbert?
Oh, right.
And I was talking to him about the notion of him being another new Dylan. And he took
I bet he loved that.
And I don't blame him. Looking back on it, I don't blame him.
No,
I was basically suggesting he just ripped off Bob Dylan's whole act. He didn't like it. Fair enough.
So
go on, what else you got?
That's DBs. That's what's it called? Repercussions.
It's called Repercussions. Great record.
Okay. This is a record I play an awful lot now.
Oh, yeah.
Grace Jones, Living My Life. I like all of these Grace Jones records she made for Ireland in the 80s. What are they called? The nightclubbing one later on Slave to the Rhythm, which she made on ZTT, didn't she? And but mainly these were all done in at Compass Point with the same rhythm section with Sly and Robbie.
Yeah.
And Barry Reynolds on guitar and put together by Alex Sankin. What I particularly like this one. Oh God, it's got something inside. Oh, shall I look at what's inside? Oh, it's just the...
I keep finding old press releases inside my records. Yeah. Which are hilarious, actually.
It's a mail order thing
for
ordering a film. And, but at the first side, we've got My Jamaican Guy, Nipple to the Bottle, and it's got the apple stretching. Have you ever heard the apple stretching?
Yeah.
I adore. So I play the first side of this a lot, particularly for the apple stretching, which is a Melvin Van Peebles kind of poem about New York waking up in the morning, which is set to music. And I love that. I love that cover as well.
It's brilliant, isn't it?
It's a fantastic thing.
It became a briefly voguish thing, didn't it? I can remember the Face magazine having people have somebody on the cover once with a small sticking plaster over there.
Oh, of course. Yes, that's true.
That was a kind of became a fashion thing, didn't it?
It was, wasn't it? Do you know, I've forgotten about that.
Yeah.
Yeah, didn't Frankie go in for that kind of thing? I think loads of people did. God, we've forgotten about that. The sticking plaster, the voguish sticking plaster.
I know.
Good one. So those are four of mine.
That's very good. Well, look, I've got, it's quite a well-known record, but I'm very fond of it and very connected to it.
This is the B-52's second album,
it's Wild Planet. And it just connects me back to a time I'm very, very fond of. It's 1980 when it came out. And it's just a wonderful way of rebooting the past, you know. And I think it's the most sunny and characterful record. It's got that Duane Eddy twang. It's got that kind of surf music. It's got the sci-fi. It's got the kind of 60s pop, the daft electronica. It's just joyous escapism.
Am I correct in recalling you used to carry a bit of a torch for a member of the B-52s?
I did.
And it wasn't Fred Schneider. It was Cindy Wilson, wasn't it?
It was.
You used to get all soft about Cindy Wilson. I remember that. Yeah.
I went to interview them in New York and only four turned up and Cindy Wilson had gone shopping.
Oh, you are.
I was inconsolable. I could barely speak throughout the entire interview. there would just be these long pauses.
Because there'd no questions, thank
Cindy,
you.
Is Cindy coming? Will she be here at any time soon? Absolutely pathetic. But they were great, I think. They were so original and... I think they're a big part of that. It's a big part of that kind of collection of groups in the late 70s that kickstarted the bigger electronic pop boom in the mid 80s.
Yeah,
that's majorly influential. Fantastic.
So that's Wild Planet. So this
Wild Planet.
So now my top favorite of the 80s is Richard Linda Thompson, Shoot Out the
Lights. Yes.
And it's funny, we were only talking to Gerard Mankiewicz, the photographer. The other day, and he took the picture for this cover. I only realized, and of course, by the time the cover was done, the only way they could get them together in the same picture was there's Richard sitting in the corner, and there's Linda in a picture in a frame.
That's as close as they could get to each other,
hung on the wall. And of course, this is famously the the kind of marital breakup record. Which I'm sure the songs weren't written directly about that, you know, but they can't help being kind of, you can't help reading, you know, the personal story into the music. And this is the one, you know, it's the only song I know containing the word, renege, you know, don't renege on our love. Walking on a Wire, and of course Shoot Out the Lights, and the epic Wall of Death, which many of these songs he still plays to this day, and it's just got a kind of toughness about it. Now, you know, I realized that, you know, since I was about 17 years old, Richard Thompson has just been one of those musicians I just came back to and back to and back to. And he's just never let me down at all.
No, and done so many different things too. So different types of music.
But he's just got that inimitable kind of, but it is a sort of toughness in the sound, I think, that is the thing I keep going back to. And I tell you what struck me looking at it. Do you know the thing it's closest to, this record, is things like Neil Young and Crazy Horse. You know, it's like Zuma or Everybody Knows This and They Were or whatever. Whereas Neil Young is regarded as the kind of, you know, the classic, the coolest man in the world, all that kind of thing. Richard Thompson is not, you know.
Not remotely.
And the reason for that is simple.
Why is that? It's interesting, isn't it?
Shall I tell you why? So there's Richard posing on the cover of a record, which is about a searing record about a marital breakup. He's sitting in the corner of a bare room. He's having a bit of a laugh, isn't he? He's smiling at you. He's smiling. Neil Young would not be doing that.
Never do that on an album cover.
You know, because you know, Richard Thompson has never looked
lighting on the magic.
He's never looked dark and interesting, has he? He's never not looked remotely. Dark and edgy. He's
no, always, he always looks he looks incredibly approachable.
Absolutely.
Very at a jaunty angle. Yeah. Pint of woolly ale available with him if you want one. Completely.
So
no, but, that's you know, true.
But you know, so Shoot Out the Lights is still a massive favourite of mine. And of course, I was reminded of that by the fact that they've just reissued, you know, all the Island and that record,
yeah,
in a box set with lots of previously unreleased tracks that will no doubt only listen to once and never want to hear again. Whereas the classic album,
yeah, is
you keep going back to. So yeah. Those are my five. What's your fifth?
Five. Well, my fifth is actually my favourite album. I haven't got many particular order, but I just found up on the roof. Just when I was looking last night, and I remember it very fondly. XTC had all sorts of great records out in the 80s, Mama and Skylarking and English Settlement, but they made two terrific psychedelic pastiche records. Do you remember those?
Yeah,
The name The Dukes of Stratosphere, which I absolutely love. There's 25 O'Clock, and then there was this one, Sonic Sunspot.
Oh God!
Produced by the great John Leckie. Do you remember that?
And I don't think they
put it out, promoted it using wonderful kind of cod aristocratic, psychedelic pseudonyms. Andy Partridge was Sir John Johns. Dave Gregory was Lord Cornelius Plum. And it's so affectionately done. You know, it's an incredible record. They were trying to recreate the world of 1967, 1968 psychedelia and had various rules. Everything had to be done just in two takes maximum. They had to use old vintage equipment. Fantastic tunes. The opening track on this called Vanishing Girl is brilliant. So they basically took tracks like My White Bicycle and Electric Prunes, I Had Too Much to Dream Last Night, and composed songs, you know, in that idiom. And I think they're both fantastically good records. It's wonderfully affectionate, brilliantly done, and I would recommend. They're great.
Well, let's hope we've given people some ideas, and if not, inspire them to go back and look in their records and see if they can rediscover old favourites.
This is a junction in the Word podcast. It separates that bit from this next bit.
Okay, any other business? We're joined by Alex Gold. What have we got happening in the next week or so? We've got this, haven't we? The Rob Halford book.
Yes.
Confess. When's he joining us?
On Monday evening at 9:30 p.m. because he's coming to us from the USA. From Arizona, isn't he?
Arizona.
Yep.
Talking about his book.
That'll be entertaining.
That should be entertaining. Slightly further out, if I can just lift it here, this immense and rather beautiful book, Ready, Steady, Go, The Definitive Story of the Show That Changed Pop TV by Andy Neal. There you go. Fabulous picture.
It's not just a coffee table book. It's virtually the size and weight of a coffee table.
You just screw in a leg.
You screw in a leg in each corner.
And there you are.
That's going to be fantastic.
So Andy's joining us. When's that happening?
20th? Is it the 20th?
Yeah, the 20th at 7 p.m. And it's worth noting that you can be in the room as these things happen if you subscribe to our Access All Areas tier. On Patreon.
So if you want to know more details, patreon.com/word in your ear to find out all the various different ways that you can be involved.
And we've got a load of new patrons too, which we must mention. And thank very greatly for signing up. We've got Jason Brooks and David Fotherham, the sensational Patrick Morgan, the inimitable Gareth Williams, the unforgettable Roger Gibbons.
If you keep going to this stage, you're going to describe somebody as abominable at some
point.
It's inevitable, isn't it?
You know? Yeah, let's miss those. Yeah, Patrick Cleesby, Malcolm Nichols, Andishe Nure, who sent us a very nice letter, actually. Nice email from America, from Georgia, saying how much they've been enjoying all our podcasts over the years. Very nice of them. Carl Mesner Lyons and James Taylor, Jeff Williams, Rob C., Johnny Fewings and Richard Lysons. Fantastic.
Oh, right. Well,
we're very grateful to all of them.
Absolutely. Nice to have them all on board. Funny thing happened this week that Neil McCormick, a friend of the pod and the the Daily Telegraph's music man, he found himself on the receiving end of the unwelcome attentions of fans of a K-pop act who felt that he'd been less than fulsome in his praise of their latest record. And of course, you and I, Mark, we remember the days of the simple green ink letter, don't we? You know, you used to get abuse on
press. People
pressing
very hard, bad tempered with their biros. Yeah.
But it's very different nowadays in the days of online communication. So I thought it would be a good idea to just speak to Neil about what was involved. So I caught up with him earlier this week. Okay, delighted to be joined by Neil McCormick, the Telegraph's music writer, critic, editor, whatever, has been for a long time. Neil, you've been having trouble with K-pop fans recently.
Well, I reviewed Blackpink without the due reverence that K-pop fans apparently require. And I started getting some objectionable points made on Twitter, which is what happens in the modern day. But it's sort of swarmed out of control where, one thing just expanded and expanded until my whole Twitter byline was filled with K-pop fans wishing me ill, threatening death, saying they were going to take control of my computer, you know, all hundreds of just messages of abuse. But that's becoming, you know, a fairly standard response to criticism.
Is it? Yeah, so that's what I wanted to talk to you about, because, you know, I obviously worked in the ancient world of ink and paper where you got occasional nasty letters in green ink and so forth, and you didn't take any notice of them at all. Whereas it's very different, isn't it, when people directly get in touch via social media?
It's become very different. As you say, back in the day, you used to have to actually take the time to type a letter in red or green ink, perhaps insert some dog shit. I've had that, you know. It took a passion and a commitment. You then had to put it in an envelope, take it to the post office.
Take it to the post office.
You know, by which time your anger has probably fizzled out.
Yes.
And so, you know, for a while, you know, every rock critic got a couple of letters in the post bag objecting to some review. And you know, you didn't have to take it particularly seriously. The internet obviously changed that, and it became much easier just to send off a message very quickly. And ever since then, you know, abuse has been a part of the job. And I think there is an idea that, you know, if you can't stand the heat, get out of the kitchen. You know, you're a critic. Critics don't like criticism. Just deal with it. Which, you know, there's some validity in that, and people are upset about you saying something they don't agree with. The K-pop fans have taken it to a new level. I'm not alone in this. They're very organized, and they will swarm in on something. And you know, it's pretty clear that 90% of the attack messages had not read the piece.
I was going to say, because you've got to buy a copy of the Telegraph or...
Well, you've got to sign up online at least. And we didn't see a huge influx of Korean signings. So, you know, they've done this to other people. And a New York Post journalist wrote an article about being attacked and given death threats. Not for writing something nasty about a K-pop person, but for writing something pleasant, which was viewed as him jumping on their bandwagon. This one escalated. They started putting in a complaint to the Telegraph via the complaint system, accusing me of sexism, misogyny, xenophobia, and anything else they could accuse me, and inaccuracy. Highlighting lots of supposed inaccuracies. There was a sort of an identical five-point bulletin which the Telegraph received many times. I locked my account. Normally, I don't. I just accept that this is par for the course. I locked my account because it was getting you know, a bit oppressive.
Really?
but then they started attacking other Telegraph editors.
So did this, was it the case that you gave this record 4 stars?
I gave the record 4 stars.
So it's broadly a favorable review, but not the 5 that they feel it
not
deserved.
The 5 that they would like. I mean, the Billboard actually ran a review written by a K-pop fan. To me, that's an indication of where we stand now. People, I'd say that's a choice by Billboard, who don't want, you know, thousands of K-pop fans attacking them. So they just give
that's extraordinary.
Give it to a fan to write, you know, a 5-star glowing review. As you know, a critic is not a fan. And that's, I don't think that's something that fans will never understand.
No.
You know, we have to have a huge range of knowledge and interests. I mean, my beat expands from chart pop, which is where this is. I thought this was an interesting chart pop record. It's pretty good, actually. If you want a chart pop record, it's really exciting. You know, it expands from that, you know, to experimental, left-wing, to singer-songwriters, and a lot of, you know, vintage and veteran. I have to have a huge array of knowledge. I used the piece as a way of talking about K-pop, and that was, you know, the big offense, that I didn't just go in and say, this is the Blackpink record and this is what it's all about. I discussed K-pop as a whole thing. Also, I was glib. And, you know, glibness is not appreciated by fans. Sometimes they don't see a joke. They just see an insult. I'd have to say it's quite a difficult one, because I was, you know, when you've created that kind of fence, I mean, I actually literally had to answer. You know, they had a 5-point bulletin. I had to go into it and write a response for the Telegraph. And, you know, it's hard to justify glibness. When I said, one of the things they were offended by was my suggesting that fans were young, which I had literally said to anyone, Blackpink, to anyone, to the uninitiated and anyone under 14. That's just a joke. You know, every British reader understands that as a joke.
You see, you're now what used to be, you know, an angry letter to the letters column and then a kind of smart-assed response in black type underneath has now been replaced by what's more like a complaints procedure, isn't it?
Yeah.
You know what I mean?
Yeah.
So you end up being dragged into the public square and you have to apologize for something or correct.
They desperately wanted an apology. Yeah, and that's it. And you know, there was nothing to apologize for except glibness. I did, you know, it's one of those things you think I'd used Google Translate on their lyrics. Now, that was obviously a joke because they sing in a mixture of Korean and English. And I was saying, you know, the English makes no sense. And I'm not sure about the Korean. According to Google Translate, it says this. Now,
well, you couldn't resist that, could you?
I couldn't resist it.
I would have been the same.
And I knew that was potentially offensive, but I framed it in quite a positive discussion. I mean, that's a bilingual nation. I'm super impressed
by
the way Korea has consumed Western pop, deconstructed it, reconstructed it, and sold it back to us. I mean, it's a very interesting phenomenon.
Yeah.
But that is not what Blackpink fans want you to discuss.
No, I'm sure. I can imagine. But look, that's we'll all be a lot more careful in the future, won't we, Neil?
Well, that's unfortunately that is one of the aspects.
It's what's going to happen.
Does it make people more careful? Does it make them just say, I'm not going to review that because...
Well, I think everybody... You can see why Billboard have done what Billboard have done, which is, you know, no great victory for the press.
The Word Podcast. Prime cuts of popular culture served fresh each week.
So there we are. You know, the traditional old green ink letter ends up being a formal complaints procedure and you have to deal with management. It's all very serious nowadays, isn't it? I'm not sure I could deal with it. What do you think, Mark?
I would find it absolutely miserable. In the old days, if you wrote something that people didn't like, they would write to you, care of the enemy or smash it or whatever, and vent their spleen. But the idea that you then have to formally involve the people you work for is grim, isn't it?
It is, really. It's just, it's an indication of the world we live in. Talking of which, funny thing, I was just reading in the New York Times magazine, pointing out that that Donald Trump, among his many kind of, you know, dramatic effects on the American landscape, was that he's made his neutered satire. You know, that there are all these late night TV programs making jokes about him, and they can't do it because he makes the biggest jokes himself. And the problem about is that satirists that they always used to say the unsayable, whereas nowadays they don't dare say the unsayable because they have to so clearly identify what their ground is. Whereas he's the one saying the unsayable, you know,
as you said, the left wing have become the orthodoxy. They've become the conventional ones.
They're the disgusted of Tunbridge Wells, yeah, of our day. They're the ones going, he's gone too far this time. You know what I mean? And he's the one who can always back away from it, saying, I didn't really mean you should inject yourself with bleach or whatever. That was a bit of a joke, you know.
It's a joke, and it makes you look ridiculous for not understanding that I was being funny.
Yeah. So have you noticed also, Alex, that that John Lydon is now come out and said he will be voting for Trump in the upcoming election? I didn't even know he was an American citizen, but apparently he is. Sorry, what did you say, Alex?
He's been supporting him for a few years, hasn't he? And I think he was a supporter of all the Brexit stuff that was happening over here as well. So,
was he really?
It seems like everything sort of flipped around.
But that's kind
what
of
he has to do to be controversial.
You have to give the finger to the orthodoxy. That's the thing that you've got to do. You know? It's the world turned upside down. Discuss.
This podcast was brought to you by The Word.